that will be, I don't know, I guess 3 weeks from now. I guess that'll be 3 weeks from now. Okay. Very good. So one very pressing Shiloh that came up this year was somebody was calling me up and he said, oh, what's the story? I've been looking at different kashrus agencies and some, you know, tell me what I can use and the CRC hasn't said anything. And want to know what's the CRC's position about tequila. So I had to kind of think to myself, what's tequila? And then I realized, oh yeah, that's a liquor of some sort. So this is a liquor that apparently people really, really enjoy consuming. And I understand from my liquor department at the CRC, at least we have the liquor expert in the kashrus department, who tells me that this is a very strong fad right now, that people really love their tequila, and there is a tremendous desire to know which tequilas are kosher Pesach. So the CRC did a lot of research. It so happens the very day in which I had received an inquiry from a Rav in Canada, actually, asking me about tequila, the CRC released its official liquor list for Pesach about what you're allowed to drink, what you're not allowed to drink. And there were a few things that needed to be checked out with respect to a particular type of tequila that was being produced. One was that we need to ensure that the yeast that was causing the fermentation of the tequila was not wheat-based. So that could be a potential chametz concern. And what we discovered was that it's actually self-generated by the agave, which is the main ingredient in tequila. It's able to generate sort of its own yeast fermentation process. Number two, that there not be any shared equipment with whiskey or bourbon products. And number three, that there not be any problematic additives. So if somebody's wondering what could be wrong with tequila, those are things that could be wrong. Now, it's another thing that could be wrong with any kind of liquor, which is that the liquor could be chametz of a lava pesach. There are a lot of liquor companies, interestingly enough, which are owned by Jews, including right here in Chicago, you have the giant Binney's liquor establishment, which is right off of Tui Avenue, which is owned by a Jew, a very fine, upstanding gentleman who wants to ensure that his liquor be kosher for the rest of the year, for Jews who are not going to consume chametz of a lava pesach. So to the extent that you have whiskey or bourbon, and other types of liquors that really are actually chametz based. So we actually at the CRC supervise a sale of all of the Binney's liquor products every single year right before Pesach. I was there just a few days ago, meeting with the owner of the company and with a non-Jew who purchased the liquor with another representative from the CRC to ensure that the sale was conducted properly. What we do in these cases, if the operation is going to remain open during Pesach, because they're not closing down all of their doors, that the chametz might be sold up to the non-Jew, but there's still going to be a sale of liquor by Binney's and its establishments in its various locations, even during Pesach. So Rav Moshe Feinstein writes, what if you have a supermarket, for example, which is owned by Jews, and they sell their chametz, but they're continuing to sell the products over the course of Pesach, so it doesn't look like it's a real genuine sale, and it's something that you have to really be concerned about. So the way in which we're able to bypass or overcome that particular issue is that we see to it that there are two sales that take place whenever you have a company of that sort. One is a sale of all the chametz, which is an absolute unconditional sale, which means that it's not just a sale for a period of time, it's a sale forever. And if the non-Jew wants to keep the chametz, they want to keep these delicious whiskeys and bourbons and consume them all, then they're entitled to do so. It's true that they don't pay the full price at the time of the sale. They pay sort of a down payment towards the entire price. But that down payment is considered to be sufficient to acquire all of the rest of the liquor. And the rest of the money that's owed is just considered to be a debt. It's a debt which is owed, but the ownership fully passes. It's not an ownership which only passes in a way that would be conditional upon payment of the rest of the price. Even if the payment of the rest of the value of the liquor is never rendered, nonetheless, it's a complete sale, and it's just that there's a giant debt that this person would owe.
Like a house mortgage?
Like a house mortgage, something along those lines. So, therefore, that's what we do with respect to the chametz. But with respect to the company itself, so then you can have a mechira lizman. So we have that the company itself and all the premises upon which all of the goods and inventory of the company are located Now, those are all sold, or at least as the case may be, for a period of time, beginning shortly before Pesach and continuing until shortly after Pesach. And then the non-Jew who has acquired the chametz also acquires the company and all of the operations. That's why we always find a non-Jew who is involved with the company. It's not just some non-Jew off the street who we say, oh, can you do us a favor and buy the chametz? And they have no idea what they bought or how the company functions. But you have somebody who is actually a functionary, an employee, somebody who is intimately familiar with all the inner workings of the company. And that person then is able to really run the company or oversee the company's operations during chametz, during Pesach. And then after Pesach, we require that there be an accounting which is performed in which all of the profits that were made over the course of Pesach are carefully calculated down to the last penny. And we have to see a calculation of that accounting that takes place, and we have to see exactly how much money was earned, and then we ask to see a check that was made out to the non-Jewish purchaser to ensure that the non-Jew actually did receive the profits of whatever was earned during this period of time, to the extent that it's important to the company that it remains open, that the person who purchases the company, the non-Jew, actually should make the profits from that period of time. So that's what we do with respect to these companies, that we are able to represent to the broader world that is out there that the liquors from that company, even though they were generally Jewish-owned, are not considered to be chametz of a lover Pesach. Number one, because they were all sold, all the chametz was sold. And number two, because the company was sold as well, so therefore there's no presumed or arguable cancellation of the sale, shall we say, by virtue of the fact that there was business that was conducted over the course of Pesach. Okay, so, yes.
So how does the purchasing the company, so the non-Jew purchases the company,
yes,
and he gets profit. Now, I assume that he needs the benefit, but the company itself, the original company, would not want to take a super-duper loss. So how's it figured out in terms of the...
You know what? That's between the company and the non-Jew.
Okay.
Right. Anything they want to negotiate afterwards, they can negotiate. But in terms of just on its face, going through the necessary motions so that this be not only the proper structure in terms of form, but also in terms of what actually transpires, we require this accounting, and then we require that the check actually be paid. Maybe they negotiate something afterwards. I have no idea, but that's between them.
Presumably the price that the person pays for the company is going to be close to the value of the profits, so that it'll wash out, right?
We don't actually do it that way. We just have a certain amount of money that is paid. That's a payable amount. So that they can actually afford to render the payment. We have a $20 payment or something of that sort. And it's worth it for the Jewish owners because this way they prevent all of their products from becoming prohibited to the Jewish consumer base. It might even be worth taking a certain amount of loss. And we've done this with a couple of other companies as well. But that's something that we do, certainly with the liquor companies. This is not even a liquor company that we certify, per se. It's just something that we're able to represent to the world out there, that these products are not going to be chametz shel a lover Pesach. And we do that with a few establishments.
Rabbi Reis?
Yes?
Would you be able to, assuming the guy from Binny's doesn't want to be out 8 days of profits, or 98, whatever, 8, 9 days of profits, would you be able to structure the contract in such a way that says, okay, I'm selling it to you, the balance of this note is due, however, if you cannot perform, I will let you out of this contract for a penalty equal to, 8 days of profits, or, some number that you approximate to be 8 days of sales, or would that...
The thing is that we want to avoid as much as possible, and this is an important principle when it comes to sales of chametz, so we want to avoid as much as possible anything that looks like a haram, anything that looks like a ruse or a sham transaction. So we want it to be as clean and as vanilla as possible. Yes, Rabbi Zelda.
How do you... work new products coming into the company during Pesach? For example, I tell everyone that sells me chametz that's from they give me their business address and this. I said, you can't even if you're not keeping pace on strictly yourself, you can't buy anything to bring into your business during this time because that stuff will be forbidden for anybody who comes in. How do you do that?
And that's what Ramosha Feinstein talks about as well, because Ramosha was Mako with the supermarkets. He said, okay, so they're committing some theft with respect to whatever they're selling that doesn't really belong to them because they sold it to some non-Jew. And they didn't sell the and therefore any chametz which is being sold. He's talking about a situation where the company wasn't sold, just the chametz was sold, and then you have the supermarket which is owned by these Jews is still selling products. So he says that's theft. But he says they're only stealing the products that they're selling, but the products that they're not selling, so that they're not stealing. So that was still, you know, sold to the non-Jew. But he says it's still a problem with respect to any new products that come in. So it's a very, very good question. What we generally do with our kashrus, administrators generally arrange is that there won't be any new products, you know, during this period of time. You know, to the best of their ability, they have some sort of a system that they work out. Okay, so now one big hot topic that has come up at this pace up, I don't know to what degree it's come up, you know, previous seasons, but there is a product that we certify, which is romaine lettuce. We know that there is the wonderful romaine lettuce that's sold by, you know, Mr. Kirshner, which, you know, is highly recommended. But there's also a romaine lettuce that has a CRC hashgacha that's grown vertically. What does it mean it's grown vertically? Does that mean most romaine lettuce is grown horizontally, diagonally perhaps? So vertically means that it's grown hydroponically. And that's just sort of like the term of art. We don't know why they call it vertical, I guess because it's high up, so it's vertical. But hydroponic produce means that it's not grown in the ground. Not only is it not grown in the ground, but it's not grown from soil, which was in the ground. Rather, it's grown like in some sort of an environment where they have water and they put nutrients in the water, but it's not grown in the ground at all. Sometimes it's grown in some sort of a greenhouse. Sometimes it's grown in some other controlled facility. But it's not nourished in any way, shape, or form from the ground, from the soil, the ground, just from water and nutrients that create this product where you basically have vegetables, you have, you know, other types of fruit, vegetables, products that are grown purely hydroponically, not from the ground at all. And the question arises, why do you want to buy this altogether? Well, one of the great advantages is that it tends to have much less of a bug infestation problem. We know that one of the major concerns with romaine lettuce is we all want to perform the mitzvah of maror. Used to be a mitzvah deraisa, nowadays it's a mitzvah derabanan, but you don't want in the process to commit many other isuri deraisa of consuming bugs. It's also yucky to consume bugs. But beyond that, it's usur, which is our biggest concern. So romaine lettuce happens to have a history of lots and lots of bugs. There was even one year when we had a shipment of romaine lettuce, which was, you know, being looked over by the CRC, and it was discovered very last minute. This was a couple of years ago or so. It was discovered Erev Pesach that there really was a bug problem, and that all the washings that took place did not really rid the romaine lettuce of the bug infestation, and we had to send out, I'm sure, to the tremendous happiness of housewives and people all over, on Erev Pesach, that you couldn't really rely upon the romaine lettuce at that particular year without an extensive additional washing, you know, right before Pesach that, you know, we were able to advise people, you know, how to perform. But it is a major, major concern. So one of the great benefits of hydroponically grown romaine lettuce is that there are practically no bugs whatsoever. And you can really get rid of the bug problem much more readily and much more easily. But the question is, are you allowed to use it at your Seder? Is it considered to, there are certain meaning, there are certain species of different items that are considered to, including, you know, what we call our standing maror, that is considered to chasa, you know, the romaine lettuce, that are considered to be appropriate for use for romaine lettuce. But does it have to actually grow from the ground in order to qualify as one of those species that you can actually use it for maror? So this is a very, very interesting question. And it also relates to another question, which is what bracha do you make on it? If you look at the Gemara has one basic assumption regarding all of the different items that qualify for maror. And one basic assumption is that it would be something that you make a berei pri hadama over. So what if you have some type of an item that has the general name of that which we say is good for maror? It's called romaine lettuce, which seems to fit into one of the categories, but at the same time, maybe the bracha is not berei pri hadama, so would that be okay? And this is the subject of, if you look at the Maariv Mekomos, I have a number of sources regarding this general issue. It all starts with the Chayei Adam. The Chayei Adam, of course, we know, the great Lithuanian halakhic authority, raised the question. He said, if you have bread that was made out of wheat that grew in a non-perforated flour pot, what we call an atzitz she'eino naku, so what bracha would you make on that bread? Would you make hamosi lechem in haaretz, or would you downgrade it by one level and say it's berei minei mezonos, it's nourishing, but it sure doesn't grow from the haaretz, it doesn't grow from the ground. So therefore, maybe you shouldn't make hamosi lechem in haaretz. So the Chayei Adam says that this is a question that seems to have been raised in the Talmud Yerushalmi, and he says that the same question at the Talmud Yerushalmi raised with respect to bread which was made from wheat that grew in a natsi she'enu nakub would also be raised with respect to any ha'adama product. He says, "Hu adin." This is the second to last line in the first source. Venerely du adin mivayli mivachin al peres brei peyadama. If you had some sort of a vegetable product that grew in a flower pot that was not perforated, so it wasn't really growing from the ground, the adamunami dafka milchuber. If it's ha'adama brei to peyadama, it has to be attached to the ground. So therefore, he says, since of the this type of vegetable product could be a lettuce product, is not attached to the ground, so maybe you should not make a berei pri ha'adam. And the Chayei Adam then, later on, the Nishmas Adam, Chayei Adam, Chokmas Adam, all written by the same author. So he comes to the conclusion that the answer to this suffix is that you would in fact not make the regular bracha. If it was bread, despite the fact that the Gemara indicates that you would make a birchas hamazon, with respect to bread that was made from wheat that grew in a non-perforated flour pot, nonetheless, he says, you can make brachas amazon on the one hand, but the bracha beforehand would only be mezonos. And so too, he says, v'nir ali, this is the second to last line in source 2, to adin denim avark berei piyadama, you also would not make a berei piyadama on a vegetable product that grew in a non-perforated flower pot, to nulo nikra adama ala mechuba, because only that which is actually attached to the ground is considered to be mechuba. He brings a raya from Shluch HaKam, we won't go into right now, and therefore he says that the bracha would not be berei piyadama. If the bracha is not berei piyadama, what would the bracha be? Shahakul. He doesn't say that right now, but we'll see that he does say that later on. So do we paskin like the Chayei Adam or not? If we paskin like the Chayei Adam, it's a kal v'chomer. If even when you have soil from the ground, you just happen to put in a non-perforated flower pot, you would make a shahakul and a vegetable. So certainly if it grew from something which didn't even have soil from the ground at all, it's just growing vertically, right? Water and nutrients. So for sure, then the bracha should only be shahakul. So Rav Yashiv, in source 3 over here, so we're going to see. We're going to see exactly where this might be a problem in just a moment. Rabbi Yashu says we don't really paskin like the Chayei Adam. However, the question is, how far do you take it? Let's say you don't paskin like the Chayei Adam, and you would make a berei pri adama, even if something grew in a non-perforated flower pot. And that, in fact, is the opinion of Ravadya Yosef. Ravadya Yosef says, and this in source above, that if you look at the Talmud Yerushalmi further, and you look at all the opinions in the Talmud Yerushalmi, there seems to be a final opinion in the Talmud Yerushalmi that really thinks that this kind of case is not a suffix at all, but rather, if something grew in a non-perforated flower pot, it would have the same bracha. And one of the great proofs, which Rav Yashu quoted from the Egle Tal as well, is that there's a Gemara in Brachos that seems to say that whenever you would make a birchas hamazon on something that you ate, so the bracha beforehand would be hamotzi lechem min haaretz. So we know from the Gemara in Brachos indicates that you would make a birchas hamazon with respect to a bread that grew from wheat that came from a non-perforated flour pot, because it says, "Oh, don't have a zimin if this wheat did not have truma samaisos taken from it, even though it's only a rabbinic requirement when it grew in a non-perforated flour pot." So the clear implication is that if the Trumas and Maisos were taken from it, so then you could have a Zimin, which means that you're making a Birchas HaMazon. Making a Birchas HaMazon, so then you should say the Bracha of Amos Lechem in Haaretz, which means that there is no real difference if it grew from the ground. So there are two authorities. If you look on page 2, the Shevet HaLevi, Rav Shmuel Vosner, and the Chuas Hanhagos, Yibadul Chaim Tovim of Moshe Sternbach Shlita, who say that the same would be true with respect to hydroponics. That if we don't hold like the Chayei Adam, when it comes to an atzit she'eino nakub, and we would say that if there's an atzit she'eino nakub, that there's a non-perforated flower pot, the bracha remains exactly the same. If it's bread, then it's hamosel lechem min haaretz. If it's a romaine lettuce, whatever, you would still make a bracha for your adama. So they say, hu adin, even if it's hydroponically grown. Even if it's hydroponically grown, it's birchas gidulei mayim. you do lehimayim, it grows in the water. That's their way of saying vertical. It grows in the water. So since even though there's no soil whatsoever, you will make a brei pi adama. What in the world is the argument to say that if it grows all the way up vertically and it's not coming from the ground or the soil at all, that you would still make a brei pi adama? So the argument is that it goes after the species. The species of a romaine lettuce is a species that grows from the ground. So I don't care if, in this particular case, it happens not to grow from the ground. I go after the species, even though that may seem like a specious argument. So the Shevet HaLevi in source dialogue says in the second line, Avalkan minze halohu brei pi adama. The species that we're talking about is a brei pi adama species. And the Shuvas, the Anhogos says, that's Rav Moshe Sternbach. He's talking about cucumbers that grow from that grow hydroponically. So he says that go down about five lines towards the end, or four lines towards the end. Amel daiti yesh shavak brei pri adama shenikra kain. Ba'afim ha'emesh mitzios yesh medina shenishtada minzei eno pri adama klal. Even if in a particular country it's not really coming from the ground, shavubam gidulei mayim, darizelo yedulei stam b'nei odom. According to most people, they look at it, they say, I see romaine lettuce, I see a cucumber. A cucumber gets the bracha brei pri adama. End of a story. And then if you look after the ellipsis, about seven lines, then Ladaiti Atopri Adama Haino Lamin. When we say Bripi Adama, it's going on the species Kefish and Nikra, Beloshim, Bnei Adam, as people understand. And if you look at a cucumber, everybody knows a cucumber generally comes from the ground. Therefore, that's the bracha that you should make. However, he allows for one dispensation. If you look at the second paragraph, he says, Umiyo, even though I think that you should make brei pri adama, if a person would make a shahakwa, he says, we're not going to put you in cherim if you make a shahakwa. So one concession, we're not going to put you in cherim. Now what Ravaya Yosef says, I'm going to draw a distinction. If it's grown in a non-perforated flower pot, so then we have a good proof from the Gemara and Brachos. You make Birkos HaMazon, you make Hamotzi. If it was a fruit or vegetable, you make whatever bracha that it comes from the ground. Fine. However, if you look on page 3, in the third full paragraph, what starts with the bold-faced letters, Ulam Megabe Gedulei Mayim Ovad, he says, there's no Yanika Me'akarke at all. There's no type of a nourishment from the ground, because the water interrupts. So he says, obviously, the bracha that you would make a shakoni abidrara, what would this be like? This would be like kiminu pitrios. What are kiminu pitrios, anybody? Mushrooms and truffles, right. So the mushrooms and the truffles and mushrooms. So, for sure, he says, because of the fact that they are not really supported, they're not really nourished from the ground, we make a shakoni abidrara. So he says the same thing would be true here. And he says, I'll bring you a further proof. They have two Torah giants, both Rabbi Yechiel Michal Tukchinsky and the Chazon Ish ruled that during the Shemitah year, when you're not allowed to do any work on the ground, you are allowed to plant hydroponically. So if you can plant hydroponically during the Shemitah year, obviously we're not dealing with something that is considered to be remotely connected to the ground. And therefore, you make a shakoni yavidro. He says, but my good friend Rashmuel Vosner wrote differently. Said that in this particular case, we should make brei pri adama across the board. He says I respect Shmuel Vosner very much, but based on everything that I've said up until now, nireh sheha ikar levarech aleim shahakol, that you should certainly make shahakol. And even if you hold like the chayyod, even if you hold you would make against the chayyodim, and with respect to a non-perforated flower pot product, you would still make a brei pri adama. Certainly with respect to hydroponics, you would make a shahakol, but he also is mekel b'dieved. He says the opposite of what Sternbach said. He said, I hold that it really should be a shahakol, but if you made a brei pri adama, you would be yotze. This is important because it also relates to sort of the Pesach Seder, and he says this is based on the fact that b'dieved, you would be yotze, he says, with respect to kimin opitrios, if you made a brei pri adama, according to the Aruch HaShulchan that he quotes on the top of page 4, so since the Aruch HaShulchan says that b'dieved brei pri adama would work for mushrooms, so it would work for hydroponics. Now you could say that's different because the mushrooms, at least they're on top of the ground. They may not be nourished from the ground; they're nourished from the air. But nonetheless, they are there on the ground. But here, this is way up vertically. I don't know how high up vertically, but it's not, you know, growing on the ground. So maybe you can you can quibble with that conclusion, but that's what he assumes. Yes.
So according to the opinion, it's based on its species. What if in the future most of that product is no longer grown on the ground?
So then it would be different. So sense of emotional stomach, I mean, people's perceptions that you look at the product and it's generally going to be hydroponic. I mean, and it's, so then it would be not be viewed as a product, as a species of the ground anymore. And then you'd have to, you know, start making a shahakol. But Ravai Yosef goes out of his way to say that when you go to the supermarket, how do you know that anything is grown from the ground, not hydroponically? Mm-hmm. He says that we're still living at a time that you can assume that it's thus it says otherwise, it says a vertical product or whatever, you know that it is grown from the ground, then you could still make a great beer, though you're at least allowed to make that assumption. So how does it relate to the Pesach Seder? So we have a couple of things that the Gemara assumes are going to be great beer, Adama. We say, oh, take a vegetable. Where is that? We have the kapas, right? The little thing that you the vegetable that you're going to dip in salt water, and then we have the maror afterwards. Now, this is significant because there's a question that is raised regarding when you make the birchas hamotzi on the matzah. So the matzah is kind of like our bread. It's our unleavened bread, but it's our bread. We make hamotzi lechem in aretz as well during the Pesach Seder, and it covers all kinds of foods, all the dishes that we're going to eat during the Seder. But we know if I make a bracha on bread, that doesn't cover everything that I might eat during the course of my meal. If I decide in the middle of my meal, at the Shabbos table, I'm going to eat an apple. I'm going to eat an apple a day. Keeps the doctor, I want to eat an apple, right? But an apple is not considered to be part of a normal meal that you eat together with bread. So I would still have to make a beret for your eitz on the apple, even though I already made hamotzi. So what about maror? Maror is like, you know, some sort of a vegetable thing. Is that like a normal thing that you would eat together with bread? It's still true. We have a koek sandwich, but all of these things are only being done for the mitzvah. So therefore, it's perfectly possible that the hamotzi is not going to cover the maror. On the other hand, maybe the hamotzi really is going to cover the maror because it is one of the courses after all during this meal. So we're not 100% sure. But we have an easy way out of it. Because when we make the beret pri hadama on the kapas, we have in mind that it should cover the maror. Just in case the maror is not covered by the matzah, it's going to be covered by the beret pri hadama that I make on the kapas. But what if now I'm going to make a beret pri hadama on the kapas, but maybe that beret pri hadama is not going to cover the hydroponic maror, right? Because the hydroponic maror really should be a shahakol. So how do we paskin in this whole debate? We saw that according to Bozna and according to Rabbi Lochaim Tovim of Sternbach, the bracha really should be beret pri hadama, so everything is fine. But according to Rabbi Yosef, the bracha should be shahakol. According to the Chayyodin, the bracha should certainly be shahakol. It's also a pink Pesach Elio 4, the Maxi Elio also says that the bracha should be shahakol. We've been doing the tshuvas to Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz, Rav Schwartz paskin, it should be shahakol, it's hydroponic, it's nothing to do with the ground whatsoever, the bracha should be shahakol. So now, what are we going to do in this particular situation? So the truth is, who said the kapas is to be beret pri hadama? Let's go back to the Chayyodim. Chayyodim says, what if I happen to have some parsley, for example, that grew in an atzei shedo naku? Remember, he's already out of the beret pri hadama territory once it's a non-perforated flower pot. So he says, take a look at source class, Chayyodim, kapas. He's talking about the order of the Seder. So he says, take your petrezeil. I don't think it's a pretzel, because that would really be a problem with the Pesach Seder. Mm-hmm. But some sort of a parsley type of vegetable. Or yerek acher, or some other vegetable. V'tovu b'mei ha-melech. And dip it in the salt water. Mevarek rei pi adama. But he says, you know what? V'mgadlo ha-yerek v'kli b'bayis. If this vegetable happened to grow in a flower pot in your house, so by definition, it's atzei shedo naku, your house is non-perforated, I hope. Like some people plant onions and they're like, yeah, right, you see this all the time. You plant onions in their house right now. Azaiva Yavarak Bray Priya Dhamma. So then he says, don't make a Bray Priya Dhamma. What bracha should you make? He didn't tell us up until now, but now he does. Rak Shahakol. Make the bracha shahakol. Does that bother you? That the Gemara just seems to assume you're going to make a beret pri hadama on kapas? No, who cares what bracha you make? Generally speaking, a vegetable is going to make beret pri hadama. Sometimes you have a vegetable that will be shakal if it was grown in a non-perforated flower pot. So he says, so make a shakal. So you can make a shakal. You go to the store and you buy some hydroponically grown celery or parsley and you use that for your kapas and you can make a shakal on that, right? So then that's one question. So if you take a look at source 15, hydroponics from the Star K. So the Star K says, oh, so what do you do if you have hydroponically grown romaine lettuce? You think that, you know, we're the only ones to think about this? He says, don't use it for maror. Don't use it for maror. And they mean, why not? What are you talking about? No bugs? Why can't I use it for maror? Can't do it. I mean, they don't mean to be mean. They're just trying to, figure it out. Hydroponic romaine lettuce should not be used for maror at the Pesach Seder. What's the reasoning? What's the reasoning? So they come up with the following reasoning. The bracha. It's all about the bracha. It's unclear whether the bracha of Hamotzi relieves one of the obligation to recite a bracha on Maris, we just mentioned. The Maris eaten during the meal and should perhaps not require its own bracha. It's not a meal food, per se, eaten to satisfy hunger, may therefore still require its own bracha. So, of course, to circumvent this issue, the halakha states that Hadam on the kapras is recited while having mind to exempt the Mara. However, the bracha on hydroponic lettuce is shahakol. Thus, that's how they assume. That's sort of a Schwartz Paskin. It's fine. We're all in agreement. It should be shahakol. Thus, the Hadamah on kapras would not be applicable to the lettuce. This would place one in a questionable position. Should the shahako be said on the mara or not? You're going to put yourself in a suffix bracha situation because the hadamah on the kapas is not going to cover you. To avoid this dilemma, hydroponic lettuce should not be used for mara. But I have the perfect solution. Just use hydroponic kapas. We saw it from the chayyadim. That's not a problem at all to use hydroponic kapas. I don't know if we certify any such product, but if you could go out and find yourself hydroponically grown, I don't know, potato, celery, parsley, whatever, so then you'd be able to use that and make a shahakol of that and have in mind, this shahakol should cover the shahakol that I'm going to need to make later on that hydroponically grown romaine lettuce. But there is a second problem. What's the second problem? So if you go back to, again, the previous page, page 4, the other problem is, don't I need something that grows from the ground? Don't I need something that grows from the ground? We say that there are certain things that you can use in order to fulfill your obligation of matzah, right? We say chitim, this is source test. Chitim, so'orim, kusmin, shipon, shibola, shua. It has to come from the five grains, wheat, barley, spelt oats, and rye. And we mentioned that it has to be something that is not tevel. You have to have the chumas and maisers taken from it. So the Gemara asked the question. This is psalchem, lamin, hey, I'm in base. What do you mean you can't use tevel? Obviously, you're not allowed to eat tevel. Products that didn't have the tides taken from it. The chumas and maisers says, no, the chiddush is, like the Gemara in Brachos about Eim Zamanin, betevel tovah min rabbanan. We're talking about where it only required chumas and maisers min rabbanan. What type of wheat only requires chumas and maisers min rabbanan? If it was grown in the proverbial non-perforated flower pot, right? You had the wheat that was grown in that flower pot, so then it only requires trumas and maisers from the rabbanan. If you didn't take the trumas and maisers, so then you can't use it for matzah. And that implies what? Very strongly, if you did take trumas and maisers, you can use it for matzah. So we see, if a matzah is supposed to grow from these things from the ground, nonetheless, I could use something which is the non-perforated flower pot. Now, how do I know that maror... Yes, go ahead.
Are we worried about mara dying with any of this? Somebody looks and sees you munching on your hydroponic romaine with a shahakol.
Yeah.
Or they don't see, you know, they know it's hydroponic and you make a hadama. Are we worried about your
marisayin?
Marisayin.
So I have a guest at the Seder. I say, don't make a hadama on romaine. He looks at me like I grew up on the ground.
Well, I think if you explain the situation, so it wouldn't be, you know, marisayin.
What if you just made a shahakol with something else as well that would cover... Yeah.
Well, what else are you going to make? We really don't want you, you know, just munching and snacking between the first coast and the second coast. And we want you to have a good appetite for the matzah. So,
two different kinds of charcoal.
You know, right. If a person really needed to take a seder mint or something, I suppose, you know. But this is kind of like assuming that you're not going to be doing this. Right. So, anyway. Well, they used to have the after seder mints, but that's a misnomer because you're not allowed to eat anything after the seder. So when else are you going to eat a seder mint? I guess it would have to be at that point in time. Okay, so the Rashash. Wait, let's get to the Rashash in a second. I want to cover some ground here. So the Rashash in Source Yud Aleph, going from the bottom of page 4 to the top of page 5, says that he remembered that it's clear that you can, because this is a question, can I use a matzah that was made from wheat that grew in a non-perforated flower pot? So he says it's very clear from the Gemara that says lo betevel, that you can't use matzah made from tevel, that it's talking about an atzah sheino nako, rehim muchak lehedya, to be skinu yosem yidei chobas matzah, that if you did take trumas and maisos, you would be able to use it for matzah. So now, how does this apply to mara? Look at source your base. The Gemara Mesachim says, How do we know the mara has to be something that grows from the ground, like a vegetable? So we say it has to be dumya de matzah. That it's not just that it's something which is bitter, but rather it has to be something which is, because it says, amatzosu marorim yochlu. We have a hekesh between matzah and mara. Whatever is true with respect to matzah is true with respect to mara. Matzah has to grow from the ground. Mara has to grow from the ground. Ma matzah gidule karka, just like matzah has to grow from the ground, af mara gidule karka, so too mara has to be something which grows from the ground. A QED, that mara has to grow from the ground, but it should follow the same way that we just got through saying that when it comes to matzah, it would be good enough if the matzah was made from wheat that grew in a non-perforated flower pot. The same thing would be true with respect to maror. So on this basis, the CRC came to the following conclusion, which I understand was based on a ruling by Rav Schwartz, although in truth, I never discussed this with Rav Schwartz, so I can't say for sure, but it is officially on the CRC website. It's an article by our own Crackerjack Kashrus Administrator, Rabbi David Cohn. Rabbi David Cohn says like this, the use of hydroponically grown romaine lettuce at the Seder is much more straightforward. Much more straightforward what? That the Star K prohibits it? No, that the CRC permits it. As Chazon Ish conclusively proves from the Gemara Pesachim Lamed Hey Amud Beis, not only the Chazon Ish, but the Rashash that we just read, the wheat that grew unattached to the ground, e.g. in a flower pot, may be used for matzah at the Seder. We just read that. The wheat that grew in an Arzi Shedo Nakel, as long as you took the Truma Samaisos, if you grew in Arzi Soil, you're allowed to use it for the Seder. Since many of the requirements are, including that it must be produce of the land, Gedulei Karka, in other words, are derived from the halakos of matzah, it follows that hydroponically grown maror may surely be used at the Seder. So this is, again, the official CRC position. You go out and you buy that vertically grown maror, romaine lettuce, certified by the CRC, so you can safely use it at the Seder. What bracha do you make on it? So here you make the shahakol, you know, but you don't make any bracha because it was covered by the Hamotzi, or if it wasn't covered by the Hamotzi, so then you have the Star K problem. So what do you do with that problem? So I discussed this, so I figured I'll ask my Rebbe, Rav Mordechai Willig, this. So I called Rav Mordechai Willig, and I said, the Star K has this major issue. The Star K says that you really shouldn't use the hydroponically grown romaine lettuce, because you can't be sure that it's going to be covered by the bracha that you made on the kapa. So I said, I have this great solution, just use kapas, you know, that you make a shakal on. And then I discovered that the Chai Odom says that that's perfectly okay. So Rabbi Willig said to me, I'm not really worried about the bracha. I said, worried about the bracha? He said, I don't know. First of all, you can say it's still a little bit of a suffix. Maybe it's Chaka, maybe it's Adama, maybe B'di'evin. If you make a Brei Pi Adama, you're Yotze. So even if you made a Brei Pi Adama in the Kapper, so maybe B'di'evin, that'll be good enough to cover the Maror. Plus, you have the additional suffix that you can throw in that maybe the matzah really covers the Maror anyway. So he said, he didn't feel that was going to be a deal breaker. But he said, I'm not convinced that it's really mar. And I'm not convinced it's really mar. Because mar has to grow, migidulei karka. I'm not convinced that hydroponically grown fiber is really migidulei karka. What about the raya? We have an often raya from the Gemara that even if it's grown in Asi Shein Onakam, it's going to be perfectly fine in terms of being migidulei karka for purposes of fulfilling the mitzvah of matzah, and therefore it would follow the mitzvah of mar as well. So here, remember, Rav Avadya Yosef distinguished. He said, what's true with respect to Arzit Shein Onakel may not be true, bracha-wise, with respect to hydroponically grown fibers. You could say the same thing with respect to Gedulei Karka-wise. You could say it's considered Gedulei Karka if you have soil from the ground in Arzit Shein Onakel, but vertically grown produce doesn't even have soil. It's nothing, just like water and nutrients. And voila, you made a clone or something, a facsimile of romaine lettuce, but it's just like, can that really count as genuine romaine lettuce in terms of fulfilling the mitzvah of Mara? So if you will tell me that it was Mesupik Ubas, I was kind of a little bit stuck, because I never actually discussed the issue with Rav Schwartz, and the first one I asked about this was Rabbi Willig, and told me, don't do it, so I can't really tell anybody to do it. But it's the official CRC position that we say that it's okay, so I told the CRC that, you know, don't quote me in my name, but just say, you know, that everyone could look at our website, and I'm not changing whatever we say on our website already. I subsequently found in Rabbi Ribiat's book, Rabbi Ribiat, everyone knows Rabbi Ribiat, Rabbi David Ribiat, he wrote a fantastic 4-volume work on Hilchos Shabbos, okay, real classic. Yeah. But what people don't know is that he also wrote a very good, wonderful 1-volume work on Hilchos Pesach. Okay, so this 1-volume work on Hilchos Pesach, which I didn't even know about until about a week ago. I was just in Kesher Stam and I saw it, so I bought it. So then I went to look to see if he had anything to say on this subject, and sure enough, he did. And he quoted from Rabbi Belsky, Zichrono Levracha. Rabbi Belsky apparently also was of the opinion that he wasn't 100% convinced that hydroponically grown romaine lettuce really counted as mara, never mind the bracha, that it really counted as mara in terms of really being satisfying the gedulei karka requirements. Therefore, he said not to use it for that reason. So we do okay. Different opinions. However, you can't go wrong, you know, relying upon something which is on the CRC website as a general rule. So, you know, there it is. And you'll figure out, you know, what to do. Okay, so that covers that particular topic. Let's move on. So another question that I get a lot of are people with pets, okay? Pets, they're going away for Pesach, you know, they want someone to feed their pets, or they're, more importantly, the pets only eat chametz, okay? The pets only eat chametz. What do you do if a pet only eats chametz? You're not allowed to get hana from chametz, okay, on Pesach. Not only are you not allowed to eat chametz, you're not allowed, los echel chametz, you're not allowed to get hana from chametz either. So even if I didn't own my pet altogether, let's say it's somebody else's pet. Let's say I go to the zoo on Chol HaMoed. That's one of the favorite Chol HaMoed activities, right? When I lived in New York, everyone would go to the Bronx Zoo. Chol HaMoed Pesach, you'd find like everybody you ever knew your entire life, okay? Would be like, if you had any enemies, you didn't go to the Bronx Zoo because you're going to meet everyone, okay? So what do you do? You're in the Bronx Zoo or you're in the zoo over here in Chicago. And there are animals, and they give you some feed, to feed the animals, because it's kind of like, fun. You're going to throw some crumbs at the animal and watch the animal eat it. If those crumbs are chametz, so then you violate receiving hana from chametz on Pesach, because you're getting hana from the fact that you're feeding the animal. Not only that, but presumably if you take the crumbs, and then you're also acquiring them, and then you also violate Bayura, Bayimatze. So all kinds of terrible violations. That's if you take a look at Source Yitzayin in the bottom of page 5. Also the Hakochem Sova Pesach, Apilo Behemes Acherim, Oshel Hefker. You can't feed chametz to any animal on Pesach, even if the animal doesn't belong to you, even if the animal is in the zoo. You're not allowed to do it. So that's one very important concern. But let's say it's your animal. If it's your animal, even if you're not feeding the animal chametz, but somebody else is feeding the animal chametz, and you're getting hana from it, so that's an isser hana. So if I gave my animal on Pesach, let's say I'm going away for Pesach, a family, we had this question. The family's going away. They're going and they want to give their dog to a kennel. Want to give a dog to a dog kennel, but they know that the kennel is going to feed the animal chametz. So that's going to be a problem. That's what the Shulchan Aruch rules. Also, you're not allowed to give your dog or other animal away to a non-Jew on Pesach. If you know that the non-Jew, even if it's not your chametz, but you know the non-Jew is going to feed your animal chametz, let's say you didn't know. Let's say the non-Jew could have fed your animal anything and chose on his own to feed the animal chametz. Then you're not getting enough, because he could have just as easily have fed your animal chametz. But if you know that the diet of your animal has to be chametz, and that's what the non-Jew is going to feed your animal, so then you have a major problem. So then, what can you do? So sell your animal. You'll sell your dog, okay? You go to the kennel, and you say, I know that I'm supposed to pay you for taking care of my dog. You pay me, because I want to sell my dog to you. We're going to do a kinyan kesef, a kinyan mashicha. We're going to do it right. You'll give me a dollar, okay? You'll take my dog physically, you'll take the dog by the chain, then we will effectuate a transaction, a kinyan, and now the dog doesn't belong to you anymore. So how are you getting hana? Somebody is feeding your dog chametz. So
why are you paying them?
What?
Why would you pay them if it wasn't your dog?
So that's not a good
paying them.
You could prepay. You pay before.
Right.
You pay before, but you're paying on behalf of that dog.
You say, I love the dog
so
much. I love the dog so much. Even though the dog doesn't belong to me anymore, I have so much love and affection for the dog that I'm paying you to take care of your dog, okay? But it is a little bit odd. That is potentially what we call a haram. Potentially called a harama. The classic case of harama when it comes to Mechiras Chametz is precisely with respect to selling pets, selling dogs, selling animals, selling cows, selling horses. When it comes to selling animals, that's the classic case of harama. Famous Shita of the Tfu Ashur, who wrote a commentary called Bechor Ashur, that's in Source Chup over here, okay? The Bechor Ashur.
So are you saying, Lamaisa, if your pet's going to eat chametz, you got to sell it?
Well, yeah, but it's not necessarily going to work. If you take a look at the Bechor Ashur, he says that there were, he says that he noticed that in his town, nobody ever sold their animals. What would happen to their animals when they couldn't eat their usual dose of chametz? What would happen over the course of Pesach? What would happen to these poor animals is that they would get sick. But they wouldn't die. They would just get sick. They would get indigestion, right? And then after a couple of weeks, they were back to their normal selves. So they weren't at their full productivity for a couple of weeks, but then eventually they'd be back to themselves. He says, why should we require our animals to get indigestion? Why not just sell the animals to a goy the way that we sell all of our other chametz? He says, no, because that's a haram hanikeres. He says that is a ruse. It is a sham type of transaction. We don't allow a person to do sort of like a ruse, find some sort of halakhic loophole against what's going to be an issur d'oraisa. It's an issur d'oraisa to receive hana from chametz. He said, if you sell your chametz, it's never going to be that you're getting around an issur d'oraisa. Why is it never going to be you're getting around an issur d'oraisa if I'm selling my chametz? Because you're doing bittul anyway. You're doing bittul. If you nullify your chametz, so then the requirement to like get rid of it, in addition to nullifying it, that's only a derabbanan requirement. But you've already gotten rid of the deraisa problem. So therefore, once you do bittul, so we allow you to sell your chametz, and now you can enjoy the chametz after Pesach, assuming that the non-Jew is going to sell it back to you. So he says that's only derabbanan. But when it comes to a deraisa type of ruse, so that we're not going to allow, and having your animal be fed chametz during Pesach, that would be a deraisa problem of Isser Hanah, and therefore you're not allowed to sell your animal to a non-Jew during Pesach, and that's why he says in my town, people sold their chametz, but they didn't sell their animals, and if the animals got indigestion, that's okay for the animals to receive indigestion. So it seems from the Bechor Shura, you shouldn't engage in a sale altogether. It should not be allowed. But if you take a look at the Mishnah Berurah, oh, and by the way, the Bechor Shura is often cited for this distinction that is well known, one second, the distinction between selling chametz be'ein and selling chametz that's not be'ein, like things that are bread, crackers, Cheerios, things that are 100% chametz, so a lot of people won't sell it. They'll say, oh, because that's chametz deraisa. I'm only going to sell products that have a little bit of chametz mixed into it, where it's only chametz derabanan. And what is that distinction based on? The Chor Shur, though, didn't have a problem with selling bread and crackers and things of that sort, because you've already done bittul. So there's never going to be a deraisa problem. His problem was exactly our case of selling your dog, selling your animal. That was the case that he had a problem with. Yes.
All right. I was saying it's okay for my animal to have indigestion for 3 weeks, not an issue with the Tsar Balei Chaim.
Somehow he wasn't so concerned about that. I don't know. He felt like, why not? Wasn't so much. Wasn't so much tzar. Wasn't so much tzar. I guess it's taka ira. It's a good question. It's taka a good question. But somehow I guess he didn't feel that somehow he said the behemah some miskalkalim meod on ezer shuah sachar pesach. They didn't go back to their full strength. Then he felt that it wasn't tzar per se. They just got weakened by the chametz. Right? He didn't say that they were in terrible pain and distress. Weakened by the lack of chametz.
With dairy farms, if you feed them out of their schedule, that may affect the milk production.
Okay, right. So the truth is, it's a good question. Maybe the indigestion is not what he meant. He meant more that they were weakened, that they were just placed in a weakened state. It's a very good question.
What about the liquor distribution?
Maybe we have to reformulate. Yeah.
Is this the same question with the liquor distribution?
Liquor distribution, no, because there you're just mamish. You could do bittul on the liquor. I can't do bittul on my animal. So now the Mishnah Berurah, if you look at source your test, says, but that's not our minim. It says, haminag merinadina seinu, that we are actually don't worry about the b'chor. Sure, we sell the animals. We can sell the animal. Have the Nachwi give you a little dollar bill. Have him, take the animal by a chain. Do meshicha and kesef, no problem. Okay, or give the behema, let the behema stay with the non-Jew during Pesach, or have the non-Jew also buy the barn where the animal lives. If you have a dog inside the house, I'm not exactly sure how that would look, but maybe sell the room in which the dog, and maybe sell the dog house. If you have a dog house or the room where the dog or the cat stays or whatever, as long as you don't tell the non-Jew to feed him chametz. Now, the problem with this shiloh that I received is that this is a dog that only eats chametz. Okay? And the kennel had a specific rule that they don't do the feeding because they're afraid they'll feed the wrong thing. Said, you give us the animal and also give us the food. Also give us the food. So he says, that's not going to work. He says, it has to come from the Nachum. The Jew is going to sell the animal and also sell the Mizonos. Say, here's my dog and here's the Mizonos, which happens, by the way, to be chametz. You have to pay my dog. He says, even if you don't know like the Bechor Shur, that's too much even for us. He says, Yesh machmirim bezed de mexike haroma. So it's very clear that you're only selling the animal in order for this non-Jew to feed the animal chametz. When it's so nicker, it's so blatant, it's so obvious, then you wouldn't be allowed to do it. So what many people do, by the way, is that over the course of Pesach, if they have dogs, so that like to eat chametz, they wean the dogs away from the chametz and they find some other type of food that is fine. You know when you can feed a dog or a pet or any other pet? Over the course, a bird, you name it, fish, where you're allowed to feed a pet over Pesach, you could feed them kidneys. Kidneys cannot be eaten by Ashkenazic Jews, okay? However, that you are allowed to get benefit from kidneys. Kidneys, legumes, things of that sort, corn, rice, beans, peas. So any kidneys, even though we can't eat the kidneys, we can feed the kidneys to our pets. So we have a whole long list at the Chicago Rabbinical Council. You look in our Pesach guide where we tell you
all kinds of pet products that have kidneys that, you know, that you can feed to your animals, and your animals will be perfectly happy. Not only will they not have indigestion, they will not even miskatakolim. They will not even be weakened in terms of their productivity. The dog will bark just as as spiritedly as before.
What? My cow and my goat.
Yeah, and your cow and your cow will produce milk just as, you know, prolifically as in the past. However, what do you do in this case where the animal taka only will eat chametz? So then he says, what you do is you sell the animal to one non-Jew and you sell the chametz to a different non-Jew. Let them negotiate with each other. So then it's not coming from you. So you go to the owner of the kennel and you sell your animal, and then maybe there's a worker at the kennel and you say, I'm not selling this to the kennel. This is to you privately. I'm selling you this chametz, and you work it out in that way. That's what I suggested to this rabbi who presented this question on behalf of the Baal Bais. I said, the best thing is get your dog to like something that's kidneyous, that's not, you know, straight chametz. But if you can't do it that way, so then just sell the dog to, you know, one person and sell the chametz to another person.
So, Rabbi, for those of us boarding pets at a place like PetSmart, is it better to walk in with a bag of the dog and a bag of the kidney of dog food and say, please feed this to my dog?
No, if it's kidneyous, there's nothing to worry about.
No, I'm saying, is it better to do it that way? In other words, I go to PetSmart, they'll do it either way. They'll say, either we'll pick our house food, or if you want us to feed your dog pets, we'll feed it out.
No, if it's kidneyous, you could just give them the kidneyous straight. That's fine.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, the kidney is not a problem. It's the only problem if it's chametz. Yeah.
There is no issue of having hana in the kidney.
There's no issue of hana.
I think that's an important to point out.
Didn't I say that?
Yes.
Oh, I hope I said it. If I didn't say it, I have to be like fearful as to what I actually said. You're not allowed to eat kidneys, but you're allowed to get hanah from kidneys. Okay, good.
Yeah. I don't know if I was stating my question correctly.
Oh, okay.
I walk into PetSmart, I've got two options. Option A is I pay them and say, okay, as part of me paying you, you need to feed my dog. Whatever you want to feed my dog is fine. I don't care. It's your choice. Your responsibility. Option B, I hand him my dog and a bag of approved dog food.
Yeah, which option B is better. Option B is better because this way you're guaranteeing that the dog's not going to have to receive chametz, and that's better. Okay, fine. Another shaila. Gimel on page 7. Hahokim beisim kol yudal nisim. People are going away to hotels for Pesach, and they want to know: can I not only get the benefit of the hotel experience? We don't have to prepare meals, and we don't have to kosher our kitchen, and so forth. And we don't have to clean up after meals and all of those wonderful things. But can we also avoid, while we're at it, the whole enterprise of Bedikas Chometz? You know, can we avoid that? So that's an interesting question. So here, if you take a look at the Mishnah Berurah, let's go to source Chof Gimel. The Mishnah Berurah says, what if you're going to sell all your chometz? You're going to sell your chometz. I know that everything in my house, I'm going to sell the chometz. So why do I have to do Bedikas Chometz if I'm going to sell my chometz anyway? I'm going to put my chometz in my cabinets. I'm going to put them in my pantries. I'm going to put the chometz in my medicine cabinets, in my refrigerator, freezer, whatever. So everything, you know, is going to, you know, be there. So why should I do Bedikas Chometz? Well, if you're living in the house, obviously you do have to clean out your refrigerator and your freezer because you're going to use them for basic products. If you're living in your house also, you have to make sure you don't have, like, crumbs that are going to get mixed up with Pesach products. So therefore, you're going to do a much more assiduous cleaning when it comes to crumbs. But what if you're not going to be in your house at all? So here, the Mishnah Berurah points out there might be a distinction between whether you're selling your chometz on the day before Pesach, which is Yudal Nisan, and whether you're selling your chometz on two days before Pesach, on Yud Gimel Nisan. And by the time the night of Yudal rolls around, next week it's going to be, what, Tuesday night? You are completely gone from your house, and it belongs 100% to the non-Jew. So then he says, in that particular case, maybe it's better. Maybe you really don't have to do a Bedikas Chometz because you're just selling the entire house, lock, stock, and barrel, with all of its contents and all of its chometz. It belongs to the non-Jew. When the 14th night of Nisan comes around, when you have the chiyuv Bedikas Chometz, there's no chiyuv to talk about anymore because it doesn't belong to you. It belongs to the non-Jew. But it might be trickier if you're going to be in your house on Leil Yudalid when the chiyuv Bedikas Chometz kicks in. So, for example, that's what we have, that, you know, issue this year, because we're going to Lake Geneva, you know, God willing, Scotland residence, you know, thing, whatever, under the CRC supervision, obviously only the best. But we're going to be in our house the night of Yudalid, but then we're leaving, you know, the next morning after I do the Mechir's comments. I still have everybody's comments and say, you know, okay, bye-bye. So, says the Mishnah Berurah, third line. Do you have to check altogether on the 14th night? Those, let's say you have rooms that you're going to close up entirely. You're going to close them up entirely. So he says there are different opinions amongst the Achronim. And some say, the Chayodim, Mekor Chayim, say, of course you have to check it because they haven't been sold yet. They're only going to be sold the next morning. And you have your keys, you have everything, you haven't sold the thing. However, he quotes from another Achon, the Binyan Olam, who says, no, it doesn't require B'dikah, because you have a mitzvah tashpisu to get rid of your chametz. He says, how are you getting rid of it? You get rid of your chametz by selling it to the Akum. That's a great way of getting rid of it. Mekayim tashpisu, uvior, and eradicating the chametz. Vlogarim yichametz shemotzi achor b'dikah, shemeshayel ma'achol ma'achor, v'enu mechuyi l'bayir akol. He says that you don't have to get rid of everything. You set aside a certain amount of chametz you're going to eat tomorrow. You're setting aside chametz you're going to sell tomorrow. No problem at all. So what you could do, and especially in this case where you know you're not going to use your house at all, is that you set aside, you put aside the chumitz in all of the places that you know you're going to sell tomorrow, and just in those open areas where you want to make sure you're not going to have a kezias of, you know, chumitz, you're not identifying chumitz that just like is lying, you know, on the floor of your kitchen. So that type of chumitz, so you should do a bediko of this. You might have to check, you know, the drawers or whatever that are not specifically identified as the places where the non-Jew is going to be picking up his chumitz, even though you say in the end that you're selling everything to non-Jew, but, you know, so you check to make sure you don't have chumitz in your pockets, you know, chumitz in sort of like the odd places where a non-Jew wouldn't expect that, you know, he's going to find it. But other than that, whatever is closed up, you don't have to worry about it. And you probably don't have to do as assiduous, you know, a checking in between like the cracks of your dining room chairs that you would have to do if you were staying around for Pesach. So I tell people you should do a bedikah, but you don't have to do quite as assiduous a bedikah. And certainly the chometz, which is those areas which are being set aside, especially you're going to sell, you know, everything in your refrigerator and your freezer, you're going away from the entire Pesach, so that would be okay. It would not be okay if, for example, you have people, since you have an empty house, so there are some people who have their, you know, their extended family coming for Pesach, and say, no problem, let your children stay over in my house. So if you're doing that, so whatever area you're going to set aside for them, like especially like the kitchen area, so then you would have to do a more thorough bedikah if there are people who are staying in your house. If you say, don't you dare and do and go anywhere in the house other than these dalet amos, this tiny little room that I'm giving you or whatever, so then you wouldn't have the issue except for potentially the room that you're giving them. Yes?
Never done it myself, but I remember in past years people are going away 2 or 3 days before. They did the bedikah with bedikah without a bracha, and they did the bedikah in the place that they were going so they could have the bracha.
Again, if you're going to do a bedikah a couple of days before, you always do it without a bracha. But take a look at the last two lines of the Mishnah. He says, even though the truth is that we really are makel, as I said, you do a bedikah, but you do it in the fashion that I described. But he said, if you really want to escape any kind of chiyuv whatsoever, just sell everything. The entire house, lock, stock and barrel, close it up after the 13th day and join the sale that all the Israelis, so the people who have apartments in Israel, participate in, which is the sale which is 2 days before Pesach. That's much better to just do the sale on the morning of the 13th day if you really are planning to go away. But then many poskim say if that's the case, then it's like a little bit of a tarti disaster if you're still living in your house on the 14th night. Then you should, you know, do the sale on the 13th morning and leave. You know, leave right then and there. Or, you know, stay in a neighbor's house or something. Say, you know, sorry, we're just, you know, coming for the night. So, kasu achronim, okay, fine. So, that's, so therefore, that's the way that you could, you know, really avoid the obligation altogether. But if you're planning to come back, some say that if you're just, like, hiring somebody to come and flower your plants, or plants, not flower your plants, so water your plants, over the course of Pesach, so that's not necessarily going to require a full-fledged bedikah if the person's really just coming in to water the plants, or do something like that, or feed the fish, you know, over the course of Pesach, because even if it belongs to the non-Jew, so we generally have a carve-out in our mechira form that says the non-Jew gives us permission to just kind of like, you know, intrude and trespass for, you know, minor, you know, purposes. So then that probably would not change the equation per se. But if you're going to have a whole family stay there, that probably would change the equation. So another, okay, we have a minute or two. Okay, so another question that arises, I got the question, somebody's going to be in a plane on Erev Pesach. This is source Hay, they're only going to arrive in the morning past the time that they'll be able to physically attend any particular siyum. What do they do if they're a Bechor? So we have an institution of siyum Bechoros. The Bechoros, because they were spared, you know, when there was Makas Bechoros and all the Bechoros in Mitzrayim were killed, we were spared. So we have we have this commemoration that the Bechorim do the fast on Erev Pesach. So, but you can get out of it with a siyum. The Aruch HaShulchan explains, because if you look at the various sources, Yerushalmi, whatever, it appears that it's really only a minig. Only a minig. It's not something which is an ironclad, you know, requirement. So we find that Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach had a case where he was asked about of somebody who wasn't able to attend the siyum because he was traveling, whatever it is. There was some unforeseen circumstance, and he held that b'shas hadchak you would be allowed to rely upon siyum l'siyum with telephone. This came up a lot during the COVID in terms of participating in the siyum via Zoom. So he held that you would be allowed to participate on telephone. So I had the shaila. This is only for people in dire circumstances. Really, physically, you should be there. But because with Mako, when it comes to siyum in general, so I said if this person's going to miss a siyum, then they, not a recording of a siyum, but they would have to be in live time. They would have to tune into a siyum, you know, by telephone or by Zoom. They could participate. If they can't, so there is the opinion of the Sefer Afar Kasasa de Anya, who says that you could make your own siyum. It doesn't have to be in an entire Masechus of Gemara, he says, even a Masechus of Mishnayos. If you learn it together with a Bar Tanura, so you do Uksin or whatever, you know, and you do it together with a Bar Tanura, you can make your own Siyum Mishnayos. Learn Pirkei Avos, you know, so I accept that. Normally, we would not rely upon a Siyum Mishnayos of one Masechta as opposed to a whole Seder. But if a person is in that type of a dire circumstance, there's room to be made. Yes, question.
How would you possibly, Rabbi, a person arrives after the siyum's over, he was on an airplane, he lands, he gets there, the siyum's over, but people are still...
No, too late, no. You got to actually hear the siyum. You actually have to hear the siyum.
What?
Usually starts fasting. Usually starts at 13, you know, the farther faster for him before. What? Can you make a siyum? That's a whole big discussion.
And I would suggest Ovadia.
Yeah, a number of poskim. A number of poskim are make Ovadia is not a sefer of Tanakh. Megillas Rus is a sefer of Tanakh, but not Ovadia. Ovadia, you have to do the entire Treyasar. No, you have to do Treyasar is the entire Ovadia. But if you do it, you know, really well and extensively with Mephoshim and so forth, so then there are, you know, poskim who are make on that.
At what age would a father have to start fasting himself?
When he's 30 days old, I don't know.
Really?
Yeah, I think so. Okay, stop here.
Right.
Okay. Kosher Sameach.
Rabbi Reitz,
we're down under the main shul tonight.
Sponsor this year tonight.
Oh, Shikayach, I didn't know that. I would have given a shout out. Okay, I'm sorry, I didn't know.
Oh,
you should have the Hirschman. Yes, Bob.
I am Bob.